court. I don't think James Madison contemplated political parties of this kind and the kind of concentration of power into a single ideological political party. The best case scenario is the law prevails, the court holds Trump accountable and strikes down these various executive orders and some of the rulings and regulations that are already being implemented. Worst case scenario is we are in for a dark period. That what if the Supreme Court does rule in favor of the Constitution and Donald Trump defies the Supreme Court, even if the court does the right thing? It's actually happened in American history a few times when presidents have flaunted the Supreme Court. We've later come to regret that. And that may be the second part of your question. That's when the people are going to have to demonstrate. We're going to have to need widespread organizing throughout the United States if that kind of threat occurs. The worst case scenario is the court itself rules against these lawsuits, and that'll be a dark day. Some of it may be corrected by congressional acts. And I just want to identify other aspects that your listeners can consider as we confront the Trump administration. The courts, I think you can hear it in my voice. You can see it in my career. The courts have meant a lot to me, and they've meant a lot to the progress of American law in the best sense of the word. But they have fallen by the wayside. They've ratified the internment of the Japanese and upheld McCarthyite periods. And there are deep blemishes on the Supreme Court. So we have to know that we cannot rely entirely on the courts to save us. We have to depend on our own activism. I'm proud of people across the country who last week on President's Day rose up in small communities and large communities to protest against what Trump is doing. I'm proud of members of Congress speaking up and growing a spine and deliberately confronting the Trump administration.
Well, Stephen Rohde, as we end our segment today, please tell listeners how they can learn more about you and your work.
Well, they can tune in to Law and Disorder every week. I'm proud to co-host this show and to guest from time to time. Independent media is crucial. You and I, Maria, with Jim Lafferty, do the Lawyers Guild show on the Pacifica Network at KPFK. There are many outlets of independent journalism, and I try to write for as many of them as I can. LA Progressive, Truth Dig. I've begun to write for Project Censored and other publications as well. All my material is online at those publications and elsewhere. And if you've read something I've written that touches you, that moves you, that is of an educational value, pass it on to family and friends. It's the circulation of this kind of accurate, comprehensive information that I think is so important.
Well, thank you so much, Stephen Rohde, constitutional law scholar. Thank you also for doing our homework for us, because I know it takes a lot of reading to go through those court cases and the voluminous articles out there. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Maria, it's truly my pleasure. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Thank you. I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Und für mich wird absolute Priorität haben, so schnell wie möglich.
My absolute priority will be to strengthen Europe as quickly as possible so that step by step we can really achieve independence from the United States.
As the world marks 3 years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Friedrich Merz appears set to become the next German chancellor after his conservative Christian Democratic Union placed first in Sunday's key election. The far-right AfD, the Alternative for Germany party, placed second, nearly doubling its support in recent years. We'll go to Berlin. Then Hamas releases 6 Israeli hostages, but Israel delays the release of 600 Palestinian prisoners in exchange.
I want to fly in the air. I can't wait for him to come. I want to go to him, to meet him on the road. I cannot wait to see him until I hold him. Muhammad is the eldest, my blood and soul, my life. I am alive in this world for Muhammad.
We'll go to the occupied West Bank, where Israel's deployed tanks for the first time in 20 years. We'll go to Ramallah. Finally, Keith Lamar just made history as the first ever death row prisoner to call in to his own film premiere for the justice of injustice, illustrated by the world-renowned artist Molly Crabapple. It won the grand prize for best animated short film at the Golden State Film Festival.
It means everything to have won this award, to have received the recognition of that my story resonates with a broader cross-section of society. And I'm really, really thankful to each and every one of you for engaging with my struggle. Thanks so much, everybody.
Keith Lamar will join us live from death row at the Ohio State Penitentiary in Youngstown. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Germany, Friedrich Merz is set to become the next German chancellor after his conservative CDU party placed first in Sunday's election. Merz said Germany and Europe must achieve independence from the United States as a rift grows between the Trump administration and Europe. The far-right AfD, or Alternative for Germany party, placed second in the German election, nearly doubling its support since 2021. The world's richest man and Trump advisor Elon Musk reportedly congratulated AfD on the results. Musk and U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance had both backed the far-right party. The Social Democratic Party, led by Chancellor Olaf Scholz, placed third in the party's worst showing since 1890. We'll go to Germany after headlines. Foreign leaders, including European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, are in Ukraine today to mark 3 years since the Russian invasion. Their visit comes as President Trump has repeatedly attacked Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky as the U.S. shifts its support away from Ukraine in a move that has shocked European allies. Last week, the U.S. opposed calling Russia the, quote, aggressor in a statement put out by the G7. The U.S. has also pressured Ukraine to replace a UN resolution condemning Russia. This comes as Trump is pressuring Zelensky to give the U.S. rights to its vast mineral resources. Meanwhile, Sunday, Zelensky said he would be willing to resign if it brought peace to Ukraine.
If it's about peace in Ukraine and you really want me to leave my position, I am ready to do that in exchange for peace. Secondly, I can exchange it for NATO membership, if there's such an opportunity. I'll do it immediately, without a long conversation about it. I am focused on Ukraine's security today and not in 20 years. I don't plan to be in power for decades. Therefore, that's my aim and my dream.
Israel has sent tanks into the occupied West Bank for the first time in 20 years as the Israeli military escalates its assault that has already displaced 40,000 Palestinians. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said Palestinians living in the Jenin, Tulkarem, and Nur Shams refugee camps will not be allowed to return to their homes. On Friday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited the occupied West Bank and was photographed holding a meeting inside a Palestinian home that had been seized by the Israeli military. On Saturday, Israeli forces fatally shot two Palestinian children, one 12, the other 13, in separate incidents. We'll go to the West Bank later in the broadcast. Hamas is accusing Netanyahu of intentionally sabotaging the Gaza ceasefire deal after Israel reneged on its agreement to release 620 imprisoned Palestinians Saturday after Hamas released six Israeli hostages. During a ceremony in Gaza, one of the hostages, Omer Shemtov, kissed two masked members of Hamas on the forehead. Al Jazeera reports Hamas says it will not engage in further ceasefire discussions until Israel releases the prisoners. President Trump has fired Charles Q. Brown as chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The nation's highest-ranking military officer is part of what's being described as an unprecedented purge of the U.S. military leadership. Brown was the second black general to serve in the position. Trump is replacing him with Dan Kane, a lower-ranking retired Air Force lieutenant general who will likely need a waiver to serve in the post because he doesn't meet the job requirements. In addition, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth fired the chief of the Navy, Admiral Lisa Franchetti, the first woman to hold the post. Hegseth also fired the top lawyers for the Army, Navy, and Air Force. On Saturday, Elon Musk sent an email to 2.3 million federal workers with the subject line, "What did you do last week?" The email instructed workers to respond with, quote, "approx five bullets of what you accomplished last week and CC your manager," unquote. Musk then publicly warned that employees risk losing their jobs for failure to respond today. He said in a tweet on X, "If you don't return the email, we assume you've resigned." Several key agencies, including the FBI, State Department, and Pentagon, have told workers not to respond. Everett Kelly, the president of the American Federation of Government Employees, said, quote, "It's cruel and disrespectful for federal employees to be forced to justify their job duties to this out-of-touch, privileged, unelected billionaire who's never performed one single hour of honest public service in his life," unquote. In related news, the Trump administration fired about 2,000 workers at USAID. Thousands more are being put on paid leave amidst efforts to dismantle the agency. The U.S. government has already removed the letters U.S. Agency for International Development from its building. On Friday, President Trump sparred with the Democratic governor of Maine, Janet Mills, over Maine's decision to keep allowing transgender girls to compete in school sports despite a new Trump executive order. Trump publicly criticized Mills during a White House meeting with governors.
"The NCAA has complied immediately, by the way. That's good. But I understand Maine. Is Maine here, the governor of Maine?
Huh? Here.
Are you not going to comply with it?"
"I'm complying with state and federal laws."
We are the federal law. Uh-huh. "Well, you better do it. You better do it because you're not going to get any federal funding at all if you don't. And by the way, your population, even though it's somewhat liberal, although I did very well there, your population doesn't want men playing in women's sports. So you better comply because otherwise you're not getting any federal funding. Every state." Good. I'll see you in court. I look forward to that. That should be a real easy one.
In other legal news, a U.S. district judge has halted part of Trump's anti-DEI executive orders, saying they promote, quote, textbook discrimination. The ruling came in a lawsuit filed by the American Association of University Professors and the National Association of Diversity Officers in Higher Education. President Trump has picked the right-wing podcaster Dan Bongino to become the deputy director of the FBI. Bongino is a former Secret Service agent who has a long record of supporting Trump, questioning the 2020 election results and promoting conspiracy theories. Bongino will serve under FBI Director Kash Patel, who's also set to become the acting head of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives. Angry constituents confronted Republican lawmakers at town hall meetings across the United States this weekend. In Georgia, Republican Congress member Rich McCormick was repeatedly booed and grilled over his support for President Trump.
Tyranny is rising in the White House, and a man has declared himself our king. So I would like to know, rather, the people would like to know what you, congressmen, and your fellow congressmen are going to do to rein in the megalomaniac in the White House.
In Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, a woman was forcibly removed from a Republican town hall after voicing concerns over cuts to Medicaid. Video shows the woman was pulled out of her seat by three unidentified plainclothes security personnel. Freed members of the far-right Proud Boys and Oath Keepers have announced plans to sue the Department of Justice over their jailing following the January 6th insurrection. Members of the group held a news conference outside the Capitol Sunday. After the event, Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio was arrested for hitting a protester. The Justice Department's announced it's dropping an investigation of Elon Musk's company, SpaceX. In 2023, the DOJ sued SpaceX for routinely discouraging asylum recipients and refugees from applying for jobs. Meanwhile, the Securities and Exchange Commission is reportedly dropping its lawsuit against Coinbase in what could be the biggest victory for the crypto industry since President Trump took office. The Trump administration transported another 15 immigration prisoners from Texas to Guantanamo Bay in Cuba Sunday, days after it transferred 177 Venezuelan citizens who were being held at the military base to Honduras. This comes amidst reports Trump is preparing to use military sites across the U.S. to detain undocumented people who've been designated for deportation. In the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, some 7,000 people have been killed in the escalating violence since January when Rwanda-backed M23 soldiers started seizing major cities. The DRC's prime minister announced the shocking death toll at the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva earlier today, adding another 450,000 people are without shelter after 90 displacement camps were destroyed by occupation forces. This is Congolese Prime Minister Judith Suminwa Tuluka.
It is impossible to describe the screams and cries of millions of victims of this conflict. Women, girls, raped, children displaced and orphaned, journalists and artists, witnesses to this tragedy do not have the right to tell us about it. This requires a reinforced and coordinated international response.
The Congolese Prime Minister also called on international actors to ensure enforcement of a UN Security Council resolution passed Friday, which calls on Rwanda's military to halt its support of M23 and immediately withdraw all troops from the DRC. Sudan's military says it's captured the central town of Soba, east of Khartoum, as it continues to advance towards the capital. One day earlier, Sunday, the Sudanese military announced it retook control of Al-Kutaina in White Nile State and broke a two-year-long siege on the key city of Obeid by the Rapid Support Forces. This comes after the RSF on Saturday signed a charter with other political and armed groups to form a parallel so-called government of peace and unity. As the Sudanese civil war and devastating humanitarian conflict grind on nearly 2 years after fighting broke out in April of 2023. Elsewhere, an outbreak of cholera killed at least 68 people and sickened another 1,900 in the Sudanese cities of Kosti and Rabak. Officials say the outbreak was triggered by contaminated water after Kosti's water plant was attacked by RSF fighters. In Lebanon, hundreds of thousands of mourners gathered in Beirut Sunday for the funeral of Hezbollah's former leader, Hassan Nasrallah, who was killed in an Israeli airstrike 5 months ago. Four Israeli warplanes flew over the funeral at low altitude. Israel also carried out airstrikes on Sunday in southern Lebanon. Hezbollah's new leader, Naim Qassem, spoke on Sunday.
We will not submit, and we will not accept the continuation of our killing and occupation while we watch. No one can ask us to give up our powers in a way to let the enemy control us. You know, we are the sons of never to humiliation.
A closely watched trial that could bankrupt Greenpeace begins today in North Dakota. The Texas pipeline company Energy Transfer filed a $300 million slap lawsuit against Greenpeace over its role in organizing protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline. The pipeline company accused Greenpeace of defamation and orchestrating criminal behavior. Greenpeace and its allies have denounced the lawsuit, saying it could have a chilling effect on free speech. Here in New York, students at Columbia and Barnard College are launching a week of actions to demand Barnard reverse its decision Friday to expel two students who participated in protests for Palestinian rights that allegedly disrupted a class called History of Modern Israel. Barnard previously suspended over 50 students and evicted 46 undergraduates for demonstrating for Palestinian rights. The Associated Press has sued three Trump administration officials after the White House cut off the AP's access over the news agency's refusal to refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America, the new name given to the body of water by President Trump. AP said, quote, "This targeted attack on the AP's editorial independence and ability to gather and report the news strikes at the very core of the First Amendment." And workers at Yosemite National Park staged a protest Saturday over the Trump administration's mass layoffs and decision to expand drilling on public land. The park staffers hung an upside-down American flag, a sign of distress, on the side of Yosemite's famous El Capitan cliff. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the world marks 3 years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, we begin today's show in Germany, where Friedrich Merz appears set to become the next German chancellor after his conservative Christian Democratic Union, CDU, placed first in Sunday's anticipated election. Merz has vowed to back Ukraine in its defense against Russia's war and has signaled a seismic shift in Europe's relations with the United States in President Trump's second term and his government's growing rift with the European Union. Merz spoke to German public broadcaster ARD Sunday.
My absolute priority will be to strengthen Europe as quickly as possible so that step by step we can really achieve independence from the United States. I never thought I would have to say something like this on a television program, but after Donald Trump's statements last week at the latest, it is clear the Americans, at least this part of the Americans, this administration, are largely indifferent to the fate of Europe.
Germany's election comes as the Trump administration's been in direct talks with Moscow to reach an agreement that would end the war in Ukraine without including representatives of Ukraine or European nations at the table. Trump's White House has also vowed to scale back U.S. military support and troop numbers in Europe. Merz has questioned the future of NATO and has suggested Europe may need to devise a new independent defense structure to replace the military alliance. Ahead of Sunday's election in Germany, U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance and Elon Musk came out in support of the far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD, party, which revels in Nazi slogans and anti-immigrant racism. AfD placed second, nearly doubling its support since the 2021 German election, the strongest showing for a far-right party since World War II. Musk reportedly congratulated the AfD on the results. Meanwhile, Vance met with AfD's leader during a trip to Munich earlier this month. The Socialist Democratic Party, led by outgoing German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, placed third. Scholz urged no future government coalition should partner with AfD.
No cooperation with the extreme right. The Social Democratic Party stands by this clear course, and we hope and believe that all others will continue to show this attitude in the coming years. That an extreme right party like the AfD gets such election results in this country, this should never be something we will come to terms with. I will never reconcile myself to this.
For more, we go to Berlin, where we're joined by David Bebnowski, contemporary historian and social scientist at the America Institute at the Ludwig Maximilian University, Munich. He's the author of a book about the Alternative for Democracy, or AFD. Welcome to Democracy Now! First, your response to the Sunday election in Germany.
Well, thank you. My response is that we saw, of course, a victory by the CDU of the CDU. We saw a strong showing by the AfD. We saw a considerably stronger showing of the Left Party, really the surprise of this election. And I think the CDU and the AfD did not achieve completely what they wanted to achieve. Of course, it's a complete washout almost for the SPD coming in with their weakest election results in federal elections in Germany. And the Green Party, as another member of the coalition, of the traffic light coalition, as we say in Germany, given the colorings of the several parties that formed that coalition, also lost considerably. And the FDP, the Free Democrats, traditionally one of the parties that was often part of governments in Germany, was kicked out of the Bundestag, of the German parliament. And the Bündnis Sarah Wagenknecht, another party that formed as a breakaway group of the Left Party, did not make it to the Bundestag, which also was surprising to many.
I referred to AfD as the Alternative for Democracy Party. It's obviously Alternative for Deutschland, Alternative for Germany Party, the far right.
That's right.
Party. I wanted to turn to the German Parliament Green Party member, Renate Künast, who responded to the incoming election results.
There is pressure and danger coming from Russia on the EU, so to speak. The way U.S. President Donald Trump is acting now, and Vice President J.D. Vance and Elon Musk, is like they want to turn us into vassals. So the big challenge now is to build an independent Europe that is capable of acting relatively quickly, that sets its own goals again. That is now the big challenge.
So the question is, who will the Conservative Party, who Merz, form a government with? The right or the left?
Well, the party will form a coalition, and this is pretty clear, as was the expected result, actually, from this election. Most likely, the government will be a grand coalition, as we say in Germany, between the SPD, so the Social Democratic Party, and the CDU, so Friedrich Merz, who will most likely be in charge of the government, and who will be elected chancellor, most likely. We refer to this kind of coalition as a grand coalition because traditionally, of course, the SPD and the CDU were the greatest and the strongest parties in German parliament. And the SPD is not anymore. The SPD came in third last night. The AfD came in second. But there's no way that I think the public would allow for a government between the AfD and the CDU at that time.
And who would you compare, which party do you think is closest to the Trump administration? To Vance, who didn't meet with Scholz, but did meet with the AfD, quite remarkably. Of course, we know Elon Musk, his Nazi salute, and also supporting the AfD. But you have Merz, who is the leader of the Christian Democratic Party, which has vowed to crack down on immigrants and business regulation. Is the Trump-Vance-Musk administration closer to the Christian Democratic Union or the AfD?
Well, I think the MAGA movement definitely is closer to the AfD, and this is what we were able to see. I mean, on the show, you already referred to J.D. Vance meeting up with Alice Weidel and not with Chancellor Olaf Scholz, which is, of course, a break of protocol. Really just going against traditional norms and against the just strong ties between the U.S. and Germany historically. So this is the party
of the MAGA
movement, I would say.
And the significance of this, the significance of this for people to understand that Vance spoke at the Munich Security Conference And he met not with the chancellor, but with the far right, you could either call it neo-Nazi or Nazi curious party. And this is 100 years mm-hmm. after Hitler came out of prison and he held what was really considered his first huge rally, 3,000 people at a beer hall right there in Munich.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you can see all these symbols, all these things that happen in history, and you can connect the dots if you like. And yeah, it's good to be to remember these things and the significance of these acts. And yeah, Nazi curious, that's maybe the term we should stick to. I think the AfD is a party that is definitely part of the extreme right in Germany, at least partially to a considerable degree. There might be other members in the party that do not that formally might not agree with everything that the extreme right in Germany, the far right, would say, but still they tolerate how the party has evolved over the last years and what it stands for now. So there's no doubt about that.
And David Bubnowski, as we speak on this third anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and Western leaders meet with Zelensky in Kyiv, Macron is meeting with President Trump at the White House, and he will be followed by Starmer, the British Prime Minister, on Thursday at the White House. Can you talk about the stance of Germany now when it comes to Russia's war in Ukraine?
Yeah, I think in Germany there is strong support for Ukraine and supporting the Ukrainian defense against Russia. And this is something that we would see in a coalition by the SPD and the CDU. However, the AfD has a, yeah, definitely a different standpoint on that, and they would agree with Trump and Vance in coming to terms with Russia without having Ukraine or Europe at the table. Actually, Alice Weidel, so the chairwoman of the AfD, came out yesterday and said that Trump was doing the right thing and that Trump was doing what the AfD was calling for all along. And so from that point of view, you see that there's a really just a very, very decidedly different standpoint towards Russia-Ukraine relations and against the war from the AfD than to almost every party from political mainstream in Germany.
David Bubnowski, we thank you so much for being with us, contemporary historian, social scientist at the American Institute at the Ludwig Maximilian University, Munich, author of a book on the alternative for Germany, or AfD party. When we come back, Hamas releases 6 Israeli hostages, but Israel delays the release of over 600 prisoners in exchange. We'll go to the occupied West Bank, where Israel's deployed tanks for the first time in 20 years. Back in 20 seconds.
An innocent man could be thrown into the depths of hell with an unspeakable horror. One death stretches back to the agony and pain that attended the Middle Passage. Indeed, what I am going through was not unprecedented. It has been done before, a long time ago and recently. It took a fellow prisoner to point this out to me. An old man named Snoop who turned me on to the healing powers of music. It is to him that I owe my sanity. God bless you, Snoop. He gave me the means to sublimate my pain and the tools to reconstruct my mentality, which in turn allowed me to see and understand that what I'm caught up in is in fact a continuation of a centuries-long struggle.
Calling All Souls from the album Live from Death Row, the title of an album by Keith Lamar, set to be released on his birthday, May 31st, at an event at Joe's Pub here in New York. Keith Lamar will join us live from Death Row at the Ohio State Penitentiary in Youngstown later in the broadcast. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the occupied West Bank, where Israel's deployed tanks for the first time in 20 years as part of an intensified military operation that's already displaced some 40,000 Palestinians. Israeli forces have continued mass raids across the West Bank, destroying homes, roads and buildings, with UN Chief Antonio Guterres expressing grave concern by the rising Israeli violence. Meanwhile, the Israeli Defense Minister, Israel Katz, said Palestinians living in Jenin, Tulkarm and Nur Shams refugee camps will not be allowed to return to their homes. On Friday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited the occupied West Bank, was photographed holding a meeting inside a Palestinian home that had been seized by the Israeli military. This comes as Israeli forces on Saturday shot dead two Palestinian children, one 12, the other 13 years old, in separate incidents. For more, we go to Ramallah and the occupied West Bank, where we're joined by Mariam Barghouti, Palestinian writer and journalist. Her recent piece for Navarra Media is headlined, "Days into the Gaza Ceasefire, Israel Declared War on the West Bank." Can you explain what's happening, Mariam, as you speak to us from Ramallah, from the occupied West Bank?
Thank you, Amy. So what is happening right now in the West Bank is not just Israel conducting what it dubs as Operation Iron Wall, a large-scale military invasion of the West Bank. But what we are seeing, in fact, is a green light of annexation. So what is happening right now in the West Bank is de facto annexation of lands. In the north, you have the Israeli army conducting its raids, displacing more than 40,000 Palestinians in the span of just 35 days. In the areas of Tulkarm, Jenin, Tubas as well. And what we're seeing in the center, areas like Ramallah, Jericho, and in the south, areas like Hebron and Beit Lahem, are armed settler attacks also trying to force Palestinians outside of their homes. So we're seeing a joint military armed settler attack that is happening in tandem and at once against Palestinians. And it is lethal. We've had at least 57 Palestinians killed in the last 35 days alone, 8 of whom are children. And this is not counting the injuries that are being sustained either from live ammunition or physical beatings and the mass arrests that are happening, including field interrogations by the Israeli army. So what we are seeing is an intensified campaign aimed at annexation of the West Bank.
As we talk about this, can you explain what is happening in Nur Shams, what's happening in Tulkarm, what's happening in Jenin, and the fact that Israel said they're going to stay for, what, a year at least?
That is correct. This is what the Israeli Minister of Defense is claiming, that in the coming year, the Israeli military will remain stationed in the refugee camps of Tulkarm, Nur Shams, which is also in the district of Tulkarm, and Jenin refugee camp. And now this comes after a massive depopulation campaign that really happened within the first 2 weeks of Operation Iron Wall, where they forced Palestinian families outside of their homes at gunpoint and then pursued to bomb or burn hundreds of homes in Tulkarm and in Jenin. So essentially, Israel was not just waging a war on the families, it was changing the landscape of Jenin refugee camp and Tulkarm. Now, within the third week of Operation Iron Wall, what we began witnessing and seeing was the Israeli army was putting up signs in Hebrew of renaming streets inside Jenin refugee camp. So this is signaling that Israel does not want to leave these areas. And you need to remember that Tulkarm, Jenin, Tubas, these are all border areas in the north. They are the only districts left between what is now Israel and what is left of the West Bank. So they're critical and significant geopolitically for Israel, especially in its attempt to annex the Jordan Valley. They're border states with the north of the Jordan Valley. And let's recall that Benjamin Netanyahu has been calling for the annexation of the Jordan Valley since 2020. So this is not new, even though we're also witnessing the use of tanks, the deployment of tanks. Again, this is not the first time in two decades that Israel uses tanks. It has actually been using them against Palestinian Bedouin communities in the last 10 years to force them out of their land. So what we're seeing is a formal and official and a public declaration of war on Palestinians, despite these tactics have been happening for the past 10 years.
Now, this is going on as this ceasefire deal we'll see is delayed or is being negotiated. The families of hostages, Israeli hostages and supporters, gathered in front of the Begin Gate in Tel Aviv Saturday, calling on Israel's government to reach a deal with Hamas that would see the return of all of the captives still in Gaza. This is Nahma Weinberg, whose cousin Itai Sversky was taken hostage and killed in Gaza.
We hear there is a proposal for completing phase two in a single move. The Americans want to bring everyone home at once, as does the majority of the Israeli public. The hostage families are demanding it. Yet, Israel's government is trying to drag us back into war against the will of the people and in stark opposition to the best interests of the nation. Netanyahu, who demanded the deal be executed in phases and not in a single move, is again dragging his feet and causing delays. He is trying to appease his extremist partners at the expense of the hostages.
So that was Nahma Weinberg, who is a relative of one of the hostages who died. She is blaming Netanyahu right now. They want to see the release of all the hostages. But can you explain what happened, Mariam? There was this deal, as has happened each time recently, that the Hamas would release prisoners, their hostages, and then Israel would. Israel was going to release more than 600, but they haven't.
That is correct. The Israeli regime is not adhering to the agreements of the ceasefire. Now, we need to recognize that according to Netanyahu's government, the reason they're delaying the release of the 600 Palestinian detainees is because under the pretext of what Netanyahu is claiming, he does not like the way the Qassam Brigade and Hamas is releasing the Israeli hostages. Now, you need to recognize that it's very well documented how Hamas is releasing the hostages. They're carrying out ceremonies upon their release. Now, if that seems to be the reason why Netanyahu does not want to release Palestinian detainees, we need to ask, would he prefer that Hamas release the hostages in the same fashion that the Israeli government is releasing Palestinian detainees? And that is with their heads shaved, that is with bruises on their faces, that is with skin disease, that is dumping bodies out of a truck into an open field. So we really need to recognize that tactically and strategically, the way the Israeli government is behaving is like an angry teenager. And yet the problem with that is that the repercussions and the consequences on entire populations is severe, and it's quite tragic. So again, it shows you the impunity, it shows you the emboldenment, and it shows you the lack of respect to either life or people's right to live freely and in dignity. And I think this is an emblematic moment of that.
I want to end with Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, speaking on about the ceasefire on CNN Sunday.
We have to get an extension of phase one, and so I'll be going into the region this week, probably Wednesday, to negotiate that. And we're hopeful that we have the proper time to begin phase two and finish it off and get more hostages released. I believe the prime minister is well motivated. He wants to see hostages released, that's for sure. He also wants to protect the state of Israel. And so he's got a red line, and he said what the red line is, and that is that Hamas cannot be involved in a governing body when this thing is resolved.
So, Mariam Barghouti, if you can finally comment on what he's saying as they move into part two of the ceasefire deal and what is happening. I mean, next week you have Egypt and Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and now they're Jordan meeting in Egypt, the Arab League, to decide what they will support when it comes to Gaza. Your final thoughts?
Right. As we can hear him say, and we've heard this narrative again, the Palestinians are rendered invisible. Again, the focus is on Israeli security. The focus is on the hostages. No mention of the 14,000 plus Palestinians being held by Israel, thousands of them without trial or charge, making them captives in Israel. So again, what we're seeing is an attempt to ignore the Palestinian right for dignity and freedom and to ignore ongoing Israeli crimes against humanity for Palestinians. So it shows a similar trend of focusing on the colonial right and completely negating the basic human right to live in freedom and in dignity.
Well, we'll continue, of course, to cover this. Myron Barghouti, Palestinian writer and journalist based in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Her recent piece for Navarra Media will link to its headline, Days into the Gaza Ceasefire, Israel Declared War on the West Bank. Up next, we go to Keith Lamar, death row prisoner in Ohio State Penitentiary. We'll speak to him live from death row. Stay with us.
In this country, most of us operate under the delusion that we live in the 21st century. And that somehow, without actually doing the work, we have overcome our history. It's not true. Instead of hanging people from trees, we use the so-called criminal justice system to perform legalized lynchings. And take this as a sign of progress. We confuse form with substance.
Okay, let's.
When I embarked on this
journey, The Drowned and the Save by Keith Lamar, written with Grammy Award-winning Afro-Latin musician Arturo Farrell from the album Freedom First, with which Keith Lamar made with support from musicians led by Albert Marquez, a jazz pianist, composer in Brooklyn. It's the first ever album created and released by someone on death row from solitary confinement. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with an incredible new animated short film called The Justice of Injustice, illustrated by the world-renowned artist Molly Crabapple, narrated by a man on Ohio's death row, Keith Lamar. He himself will join us live from death row after we play this film. Keith Lamar has long maintained he was wrongfully convicted and is fighting his pending execution. The Justice of Injustice just won the grand prize for the best animated short film at the Golden State Film Festival. Keith Lamar made history by being the first ever death row prisoner to call in to his own film premiere to engage the audience. This is the full short film in which Keith Lamar describes how he found himself sentenced to death after the 1993 Lucasville prison uprising at the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility where he's held. This is The Justice of Injustice.
My name is Keith Lamar. I'm a poet, author, and musician. For the past 31 years, I've been in solitary confinement, buried under the never-ending agony of sensory deprivation. On January the 13th, 2027, the state of Ohio intends to kill me. I'm innocent. Thousands of people around the country and the world have rallied around my cause, joining me in my demand for justice. Here's my story. When I was 19 years old and selling drugs, a group of would-be robbers in search of money forced their way into my apartment. A shootout ensued, and regrettably, I took someone's life and was myself shot twice in the legs. Facing a long prison sentence and on the advice of counsel, I pled guilty to murder and was sentenced to serve 18 years to life. Determined to redeem myself and make good on my potential, I completed my GED, enrolled in college, and became a voracious reader in an attempt to repair myself to society. I was in the fourth year of my sentence when, in 1993, a riot erupted inside the prison. Apparently, a group of Muslim prisoners on religious grounds refused to submit to mandatory tuberculosis testing and were given an ultimatum: take the test or else. Amid rumors of a forced inoculation, the Muslims took over the prison in protest, releasing some 400 prisoners from their cells and setting into motion an 11-day standoff that would ultimately claim the lives of one guard and nine prisoners. I was on the recreation yard when it all began. A guard came running out of the building with blood streaming down his face. followed by a mass prisoner who was carrying a weapon and yelling, "We've taken over." Against my better judgment, I went inside to check on my personal belongings. A fatal mistake. It was complete chaos. When I made it to my assigned location, I discovered that it was being used as a holding area for hostages, both guards and prisoners. I was thereafter approached by a masked prisoner who gave me the option to either participate or leave. I chose to leave. Hundreds of us gathered on the yard, waiting as the National Guard and Highway Patrol took up watch outside the perimeter fence. Later, when dead bodies were dumped into the yard, they stood by and did nothing. It was as if I was trapped inside a nightmare. Around 2 a.m. the following morning, we were rounded up and herded into the gymnasium, where we were stripped naked and then violently forced in random groups of 10 into cells meant for one person. Stressed and stretched to the limit, a fight broke out over food. Tragically, I stood back and watched as a man named Dennis Weaver was held down by 3 prisoners and choked to death. It was a cowardly thing to do, and I can now see and admit that. But at the time, I was worried about my own life. When I was later questioned by authorities, I claimed to have been asleep. It was my way of telling them that I didn't want to be involved. But it was too late. Because I had gone into the hostage area without wearing a mask, my name would be mentioned among a vast array of potential suspects. Even though the state concedes that I was never affiliated with any of the gangs said to have presided over the riot, the fact that I was already serving time for murder would play a big part in their decision to indict me. Ultimately, I was charged with 9 counts of aggravated murder. I couldn't believe it. Mind you, it was never expected that I would actually demand a trial. He copped out once, he'll cop out again, was the prevailing belief. In fact, no sooner than I was indicted, I was offered a deal. Plead guilty and we'll run the time concurrent with the time you're already serving. In other words, I would have gotten off easier had I actually killed someone. But why me? Why was I singled out for this undeserved retribution? It's a good question, one that I've spent the better part of 3 decades trying to explain. Here's what I can tell you. When the riot came to an end, overzealous officials rushed into the prison without first securing the massive crime scene, rendering inadmissible some 22,000 pieces of evidence. So there was absolutely no evidence to link anyone to crimes. This meant the state had to rely solely on the uncorroborated testimony of jailhouse informants, the most unreliable witnesses of all. What to do? Well, the first thing the state did was enlist the help and expertise of the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office. This was not a random selection. Hamilton County has the dubious distinction of convicting and executing more than half of all death row prisoners in the United States. And how have they been so successful? The answer is simple and deadly. Through the impaneling of all white juries, the use of paid jailhouse informants, and the intentional withholding of exculpatory evidence. I have now in my possession the statement of an actual perpetrator who admitted to murdering someone for whom I was sentenced to death. And this is only the tip of the iceberg. They withheld so much more. It's over 3 decades later now, and I'm still in solitary confinement, being tortured because I refuse to plead guilty to something I didn't do. I'm innocent. Look, we kid ourselves when we speak of justice. Until we have a process that holds everyone equally accountable for their actions, this system will remain what it has always been, a punishment system. And as we all know, those who don't have the capital get the punishment.
That's the new award-winning short film, The Injustice of Justice, illustrated by the world-renowned artist Molly Crabapple, narrated and written by Keith Lamar, who's fighting to raise awareness about his case and death row. He faces execution January of 2027. The film, The Injustice of Justice, just won the grand prize for the best animated short film at the Golden State Film Festival. Keith Lamar has been held in prison for 36 years, 32 years in solitary confinement, 30 years on death row. His self-published memoir is condemned, the whole story. He's joining us now live from death row at Ohio State Penitentiary. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Keith Lamar.
How are you? It's such an honor and pleasure. I can tell you, I'm not just speaking for myself, but for so many people who are inside. We have been listening to you for decades, and so it's quite an honor, quite an honor. Thanks so much.
Can you talk about the making of this film, explaining your case and what you're hoping to accomplish right now? You have made this film. You do live concerts that are performed around the world, remarkably, where you're joining from death row. You have book clubs where your own book is read, but where you also lead in discussion of other books as well with high schools and other places. Talk about your message, Keith.
Well, I from the very beginning, just wanted to stand on my innocence. You know, it was never really a matter of me not wanting to speak out, to stand up for myself. That was the whole point of me demanding the trial. You know, but the whole system, I soon found out, is centered around obedience, around operating within prescribed parameters and whatnot. And I was advised to remain quiet during my trial and thereafter, and I did. You know, I went along with it. You know, that's what we do. And other smarter, more learned people would speak on my behalf, would stand up and fight for my life, you know, and I believe that. And I just kept going deeper and deeper into the darkness until I found myself in this really, really desperate place where I was really standing on the brink of my existence. You know, I had to find out the hard way that in order for my life to be mine, that I had to stand up and claim it. You know, so that was really the thing that was the catalyst that pushed me to start speaking up and reaching to utilize my own agency. And all of these things that you just mentioned is a product of that general thrust, you know, that thing that just coming to the conclusion that if I don't stand up right now, then I might lose my life. And so that was the thing that kind of started the movie. You know, I first started, I wrote the book that you mentioned, Condemned, and that was over 200 pages. And not long after that, a dear friend of mine, Lloyd Swain, produced a documentary, which was 30 minutes. And so we was trying to figure out a way to condense it even more because, you know, of course, people have short attention spans. I understand that people have their own problems, have their own lives to live. And so, you know, it's asking a lot to ask someone to sit down and read a 200-some page book or 30-minute documentary. But we thought that if we condense the story into a 7-minute short, then possibly that could garner more attention. So that was the whole impetus behind creating the movie. You know, my friend, my campaign manager, Ann Goodell, was at the museum, Bryan Stevenson Museum in Alabama, and saw a movie that Molly Crabapple had produced. And she had the idea from that maybe this could be applied to my story and we can, you know, put forth a similar project. And we contacted Molly and her team, and, you know, was able to raise the funding through this really kind individual named David Rouse. And, you know, next thing, you know, we know we had a movie on our hands. And so, yeah, I'm really, really grateful for the whole process, for sure.
Keith Lamar, in your book, Condemned, about Bobby Sands, if you can explain who he is, his hunger strike, and how it inspired you to go on a hunger strike, which led to your case being known. I mean, you've been written about in the New York Times. You have jazz greats playing with you, supporting your cause.
Yeah, one of my friends who I think you might know, named Stoughton Lynn, was a famous historian, social activist. He, in the beginning, when I was first sentenced to death row, he somehow found his way into my life. And he sent me that book by Bobby Sands, Nothing But an Unfinished Song, written by Dennis O'Hearn, who has since become a very close friend of mine. He sent me that book, and as I was reading it, it felt as if I was being sent a message. If I had been pleading with these people, it was going on 18 years in a civil suit with 8 years, all to no avail, and, you know, I was reading this book, and it was almost a last-ditch effort before I was about to give up. And Bobby Sands and his comrade, Bobby Sands, for those who don't know, was an Irish prisoner who, along with several of his comrades, went on a hunger strike in Ireland. And, you know, some of their demands were very basic, just to be treated as human beings, which, of course, resonated with me. And not long after I finished that book, I reached out to the author, Dennis O'Hearn. I wrote him. We struck up a correspondence. He came to see me. We became really close friends. And I decided to undergo enact a hunger strike myself, along with several other prisoners here at the Supermax, went on hunger strike. And after 18 years of not being able to break through court cases and all that, in 12 days of being on a hunger strike, I was sitting in the visiting room with my family. Mm-hmm. And that was like a seminal moment in my journey. It kind of taught me that if anything is going to change, you have to stand up and speak out, you know, on your own. And, you know, one of my literary heroes, Richard Wright, he wrote in his book, Black Boy, that if you speak out who you are, you will discover that you are not alone.
Keith
and,
Lamont,
you know, being a solitary confinement.
I wanted to bring in your lawyer, Keegan Stefan. In one of Trump's first executive orders, January 20th, was to restore the death penalty, Trump said, which includes the order that the attorney general ensures all states have necessary drugs. This is Keith's second execution date. What is it? January 13th, 2027. If you can explain what happens right now in court, where the case stands in court, and the role of the Ohio governor, Mike DeWine, the position he has taken, since he, not Trump, would decide what happens ultimately to Keith Lamar.
Yes. Hi, Amy, and thanks for elevating Keith's case. You know, Keith, unfortunately, exhausted his direct appeals long ago. The state courts and federal courts looked at his trial and determined incorrectly, that there were no constitutional deficiencies and upheld his conviction and his death sentence. I do think that any fair-minded jurist looking at his trial now would deem it unconstitutional and overturn his convictions. Unfortunately, the only way back into court is to find newly discovered evidence. So me and a team of attorneys have been reviewing all the records in his case and talking to witnesses for the last 2 years, trying to turn up newly discovered evidence. We have discovered a lot of new evidence supporting Keith's innocence. You know, I started as a skeptic. I'm a prison abolitionist, definitely an abolitionist of the death penalty. It doesn't matter to me if he's guilty, he shouldn't be put to death. But I can tell you, after looking at the record, talking to witnesses, there is no doubt in my mind that he is actually innocent. And we are working to put together a motion based on the new evidence to get back into court, so that we can prove his innocence before his execution date. Unfortunately, you know, there is very little justice in the justice system, as Keith has noted. So it's going to take much more than just litigation. We need a mass movements of people, you know, speaking out, acting out, and pushing the governor to pause his execution once again while we litigate.
Let me give the last word to Keith Lamar. Keith, you're scheduled to die January 13th, 2027, second execution date. First was for lack of drugs to inject into you. Your final message is, May 31st, they're expected to have a concert at Joe's Pub here. It's your 56th birthday then.
Yes, that's right. You know, I've been living under the threat of death, as you noted, at the outset for over 3 decades. So it's not dying you know, I've already made peace with the fact that I'm going to die at some point and someday. All of us are. But the thing that really drives me is I'm here. How can I live? You know, you reference all the things that I've accomplished since being on death row, and all those things come from a desire just to live because I'm alive. You know, I had these really amazing musicians come into my life, Albert Marquez, Arturo Ferro, Caroline Davis, Elsa Nielsen, you know,
Keith,
small,
we're going to have to leave it there, Hughes, but we're going to continue the conversation and post it online at democracynow.org. Keith Lamar, artist, teacher, writer, death row prisoner, speaking to us from the Ohio State Penitentiary in Youngstown. I'm Amy Goodman.